Good morning. Protecting the youngest among us is the aim of both the Keiki Caucus and the Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii. Today, we'll look at the bills on their legislative agendas, from opening doors to more preschoolers to hiking the tax on big cigars. Senator Carl Rhodes and Coalition Executive Director Jessica Yamauchi join us this hour. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Author Barry Lopez has written movingly about the relationship of people and the cultures they create to the natural world. He's with us in our studio. And Daniel Cheng is a young performer on a whirlwind these days. He's in rehearsals to join the touring company of Hamilton, and he'll share the excitement of being in a hit show.
That's the conversation for this Tuesday, January 31st. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
It's kind of an ongoing effort to make sure we get air to breathe.
That would be exactly the point of the T-shirts that a lot of folks were wearing at the Capitol, you know, because you and I were both there, and on opening day, perhaps you were there too, and saw a lot of young people in blue T-shirts with a drawing of a red car and hashtag Breathe Aloha on the front. The Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii is a project of the Hawaii Public Health Institute. Many of its members were walking the halls on opening day to generate support for bills to fund tobacco education and bills that meet its agenda. Now, one is a bill to increase the tax on large cigars. It's now passed first reading, is scheduled for a hearing tomorrow. But why just increase the tax on big cigars? Jessica Yamauchi is the executive director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute. She's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So why just single out large cigars in that long litany of taxation?
Well, we actually have another bill also that would impose a tax on e-cigarettes. So it's not just large cigars. They're just in different bills. But this one, large cigars are actually categorized separately in the law right now and are taxed at a different rate from other tobacco products.
Why is that so?
You know, I wasn't there when it was set into law in the beginning, but I think large cigars have always had a separate definition to them, and the tax that for them were 50% of the wholesale price versus other tobacco products, which is at 70% of the wholesale price.
Now the idea is to make it either 50 cents per large cigar or 50% of the wholesale price. Why not keep it consistent across the board?
Well, and actually, so that's a different bill that we actually are strongly opposed to, because that would lower the cigar tax. And that's an effort we've actually been fighting for the last 4 years now. It keeps resurrecting each legislative session. And, you know, it's a movement that we have been seeing happen across the country, slowly but surely. Each year, one state seems to adopt it. Most have not yet, though. You know, majority of states have not implemented any kind of cigar tax cap. And we strongly oppose it because we should never be looking at lowering a tax on a tobacco product.
Does this perhaps speak to the idea that tobacco policy in total needs to be reevaluated so it's more consistent and you're not looking to one area for this tobacco product and one area for another, and also to include e-cigarettes, now that we know that they are in fact tobacco products?
Right. So we do want e-cigarettes to have a tax, as you just mentioned. You know, now that they're deemed by FDA as tobacco products, they're the only tobacco product out there without any kind of tobacco tax attached to them. And we do think it would be ideal to have it taxed the same way that the other tobacco products are taxed. And ideally, cigars should be taxed in that same manner, too. It's difficult to tax other tobacco products exactly the same as cigarettes just because of the packaging and the I guess, less regulations that are around it on the standardized packaging makes it impossible to tax them exactly the way that we tax cigarettes. But I think that we could tax all other tobacco products the same.
The American Lung Association just released its State of Tobacco Control survey not that long ago, and Hawaii got an F under tobacco prevention and cessation funding. Does the lack of constancy within the way we are taxing tobacco products now speak to the fact that we're not doing such a great job and seeing that funding stream through to education?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I think what we have to remind folks is that currently there are taxes on cigarettes and other tobacco products and large cigars, but none of what's collected on any of those tobacco taxes goes towards tobacco prevention and control. There is some money that goes towards tobacco prevention and control from the master settlement money, but that has declined a little bit over the years, and so we haven't put in any additional funds into tobacco prevention and control, and it's really a shame that nothing from our tobacco taxes currently goes towards tobacco prevention and control, which is really it's really critical. Every time there is a tax increase, you will see a certain percentage of the population decide to quit. It will help prompt people to quit, and you need to have funding for quit services to be adequate to really help folks.
Do you see anything in this legislative session that would meet that key element of your particular agenda, that we have more funds for education and cessation funding?
Well, we will definitely be asking for it with the cigar tax increase proposal and the e-cigarette tax proposal, so that if these tax increases do occur, that we'd like a percentage of the revenue to go towards tobacco prevention and control.
Jessica Yamauchi, what percentage would you consider to be fair?
Well, I think that there's a lot of great programs out there, and because nothing goes to tobacco prevention and control, we would be happy with a portion of it. You know, I think if 50% of it could go, that would be fabulous. But we know that there's a lot of needs out there. But I do think it's important that at least a percentage of it really go towards it. And, you know, when we've done public opinion polling, numbers are very, very strong that there's strong support that every time that there's a tobacco tax increase, that some of that funding should go towards tobacco prevention and control.
There are some people who sort of feel that, well, this must mean that we've done such a good job, we don't need to put any more strength into it. But yet that's exactly the point in which other states have seen their incidence of tobacco use increase, has it not?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And what we have to remember is it's not something that just gets fixed and you don't need to continue funding it. The industry is constantly changing and marketing, and they don't stop. And they don't stop spending the marketing dollars that they do. So we cannot stop spending the prevention dollars.
Especially considering that, you know, every so many years we get a new generation that might find its way to tobacco products.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen e-cigarettes pick up like nothing before. I mean, they really have been able to change the social norm around smoking again. And they're just so attractive to youth. And we've seen an incline for the first time in many years.
So what would you think would be a fair way to tax e-cigarettes?
Well, as I mentioned, I think really it should be taxed the same way as other tobacco products are taxed. And so it should be a percentage of the wholesale price.
But there are so many different prices. When you look at the way the law is written now, there are so many different taxes for little cigarettes, for cigarettes, for little cigars. Now, certainly we've been talking about big cigars. What would be a fair and consistent tax
right.
that you'd like to see perhaps all the way through for any tobacco product?
So for all of those other tobacco products, they're actually all taxed at 70% of the wholesale price. We have your cigarettes that are taxed at $3.20 a pack. We have your other tobacco products that are taxed at 70% of the wholesale price, and then you have large cigars. So there's really three categories. And so we would like e-cigarettes to be taxed the same way that other tobacco products are taxed, which is at 70% of the wholesale price.
So then what does it mean when you read through this current bill that shows the law as written now, where it says, for example, that an excise tax equal to, you know, 6.5 cents for each cigarette sold, or an excise tax equal to 7 cents or 8. I mean, it looks like it's very different when you read it through, and yet to hear that they're all taxed at 70% of wholesale.
Well, so the cigarettes, the way that the law is written, it comes out to $3.20, but they actually, the tax is actually imposed on each cigarette. It's just that there's standard packaging, so every pack has 20 cigarettes in it, so we know that it comes out to $3.20. And so when you see that, it's just the increases that have happened over the years. And so that's why really we have three different categories of how of tobacco products and their taxes.
Which sometimes makes it confusing when people are trying to look at this. Is there any way of being able to make this simpler and just more cost effective all the way across the board? I mean, cost effective in terms of being able to fund education and be able to have a tax structure that's a lot easier to understand.
That might be a question for the Department of Taxation. I'm not sure if there's a way to make it simpler. I think we could definitely have just the two categories, your cigarettes and then other tobacco products. We probably don't necessarily need to have that third category of large cigars. But because of the way the packaging happens for other tobacco products, and there are so many different things, there's not an easy standard way to tax them compared to cigarettes, where, like I said, you know, it's mandated that there's 20 in a pack. The weight is set, everything is set with those and the regulations around them. And so taxing the cigarettes at $3.20 is easy to do compared to other tobacco products when you're really dealing with different types of products.
And
the market continues to change.
And what about things like, you know, chewing tobacco?
Right.
With that has some real issues surrounding it now with what a form of nicotine is being used as, you know, as a component of it.
Right. And so they're taxed at 70% of the wholesale price.
All right. Well, we're going to see what happens with big cigars and what's so special about big cigars that they need a special category.
Exactly. Thank you.
And whether or not we get a tax on e-cigarettes, we'll be talking to you about that later on in the session, too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jessica Yamauchi is the executive director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute and formerly served as the policy director of the Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii. It's The Conversation on Statewide Member-Supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, author Barry Lopez on the importance of sacred ground to cultures around the world. But first, your backyard quiz about our world.
Yesterday, we took a look at a proposed toll road for Hawaii's Honolulu's Interstate H1. If you've spent any time on Oahu, you've most likely spent more than you want on H1. And that highway, which runs east to west along Oahu's south shore, passes such landmarks as Diamond Head and Pearl Harbors, known for having some of the nation's worst traffic. The congestion is nothing new, however. It's been a problem for so long that in 1968, barely a decade after the first sections of H1 opened, another interstate was proposed for urban Honolulu. The freeway would have been designated Interstate H4, with H2 and H3 already existing in some form by this time. For today's quiz, we want to know where was construction of Interstate H4 proposed? Make sure to be specific. The plans covered two well-known thoroughfares that exist today. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm James Macy from Makakilo. You're listening to member-supported HPR2 live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Barry Lopez has written extensively about the relationship of indigenous people to the land, a subject for which the people of Hawaii will provide a ready audience. He's speaking tomorrow evening at UH Manoa about sacred ground and reconciliation, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Barry. Thanks
morning.
For coming in.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. Obviously, there are many, many parallels to the different places you visited in terms of how people have created a culture based on the environment they live in, right?
Right.
And in Hawaii, since that has mostly occurred in isolation, that's especially clear, wouldn't you say?
I would say, but my caution about all of this to myself when I write about a place is don't get it in your head that everything is the same all around the world.
No.
The relationship to place is inflected differently mm-hmm. by every culture. So somebody like me who sojourns in different places, the first thing I look for is where is my foundation? What are the things that are generally true in most cultures? And then take as close a look as I can
sure.
with all of my cultural blind spots at what people do here that is a new representation of compassion or a new representation, in the sense that it's not known to me,
mm-hmm.
Of love. I can't recall in any place that I've been that there's any discussion around what here is aloha. This is a fabulous idea of shared breath that includes non-humans and the land that as soon as I began to understand the depth of that word, I began to understand a part of the magnificence of life in Hawaii. And I feel moved to want to tell other people about this is how Hawaiians do it.
Because in a number of ways, Hawaii is clearly distinctive. It's the most isolated place on Earth, for example. Geographical isolation, confluence of so many cultures here. It can't be that similar to other places, can it?
No, but we become self-satisfied, not to correct you, but Hawaii's got all of these jets and ships coming in every day. So
yeah.
It is isolated geographically, but so much of what passes for information that we need comes to us electronically. So it's not as out there, if you will, as some places I've been and actually have grown to prefer.
Yeah.
I've worked on, I think I can ever keep track of it, but I think on three separate occasions worked in the interior of Antarctica, and it was one-way radio communication. We were on once every 24 hours, and we knew that if something happened in the world that affected us, the death of a child or something like that, we wouldn't know about that until they came to get us at the end of our 45-day field experience.
Yeah.
And I think there are advantages to isolation. one of which, I mean, how many people can you meet walking down the street in Honolulu who, if you gave them the gift of not being disturbed, would be forever grateful? You cannot move in American culture without being badgered by advertising and people who have something to sell you, or people who are, because it's a consumer society, they have no choice about having a job or not having a job.
Yeah.
And because they have a job, they have to make something to sell, even if it's garbage. And so they've got to make a way of selling you something, some gimmick. So they're in your ear all of the time. And when I would be in the field in either in the high Arctic or in the middle of the Tanami Desert or in Antarctica, which has been my great privilege as a writer to be able to go to those places, we weren't in contact with anybody but the land. We weren't in contact with anybody but ourselves. And in those times, issues of race, of cultural difference, absolutely disappear. They're of no practical use.
That which is probably as close as you could get to the experience of pre-contact Hawaii. And when I was thought about what you were saying about aloha and the whole notion of love tied to breath, tied to the environment, tied to life itself, those notions were formed in an isolated pre-contact environment, which really wasn't that long ago.
No, of
course. Mere hundreds of years.
Yeah, till Mr. Cook came.
Yeah, and but that those ideas were fully formed upon his arrival, and they had been created in isolation from the rest of the
world. An interesting question to me with indigenous people is, how have you made it this far from the period of contact? So if you take an idea like aloha, first of all, it's cultural, so it's time tied, and that means that here's how it looks to us today, and tomorrow it'll be a little bit different. So, you know, Hawaii is not a place of being, it's a place of becoming. Mm-hmm. Everything is evolving, and the miracle to me, I don't know that much about Hawaiian indigenous culture, but Native American cultures of various sorts, Pueblo cultures in the Southwest, or Sundance cultures on the Northern Plains. Wherever you go, you find these magnificent ideas that are still in process, and they have people have kept them alive. The elders have kept these ideas alive through hundreds of years of persecution. You just take a step back and say, well, that must be a pretty good idea. So a question for me is, how do you go into a reservation in the mainland, 80% unemployment, drug and alcohol addiction problems, endless nightmare, they're still here. And senior people are still advising people, even if nobody is listening to them from time to time, about what it means to be human and to conduct yourself in a just and loving way. So my kind of mantra for myself when I'm with traditional cultures is to tell myself, listen up. You can never be like the people you are traveling with, but they carry something that they have taken care of through all kinds of hell and high water. And those are the ideas that make human beings, that give human beings their dignity.
Isn't that a sign of hope for future hell and high water?
And speaking of which, where are we now?
Well, somewhere at the confluence of hell and high water.
Right. Yes, it is. You know, I reflect on this because after the election, so many Native people I talked to said, oh, well, welcome to where we've always lived.
Yeah.
With repressive authoritarian kind of soi-disant people who are taking away they're like a parasite on the core of what it means to be a good woman or a good man.
Well, let's hope that there's some power in the whole. Let's hope there's some power to being a good woman and a good man.
Oh, of course there is. And what we have to do now, of course, is encourage each other. I often think of this example from crane people, you know, cranes flying, mm-hmm. migrating. They don't draft behind each other like geese do. They fly in a straight line, yeah. more or less, strung out a mile and a half. And what they're looking for is a thermal, because they reach altitude and then they slowly start to sink as they're migrating in one direction. So you're looking left and you're looking right, you're looking left, you're looking right, and then one bird will start to rise. And everybody goes there, rises on the thermal, and spreads out again. The lesson there is it is everybody. It's not just one person.
Good lesson, Barry. Thanks very much for coming in.
I'm delighted.
Pleasure to talk with you.
See you tomorrow night.
All right. Author Barry Lopez will be the host of a reading and informal talk tomorrow evening at the UH Manoa Art Auditorium. And you can find out more about that on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
In honor of Valentine's Day, entertainer Willow Chang presents an evening of songs she calls The Seven Faces of Love on Saturday, February 11th in the Atherton Studio. They're beloved tunes from Broadway, jazz, pop, and beyond. Treat yourself and a loved one to tickets by calling 955-8821 during business hours or by going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Firefighters and lifeguards risk their lives to help residents and visitors, but who helps them with their wish list to do their jobs better? Over the last 20 years, it has been a family foundation started by a couple whose son died before rescuers could get to him for want of extra long ropes. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
I remember this very sad case of 25-year-old Daniel Sayer, who went off to go for a nice hike on the Big Island into some areas that are dangerous, but he unfortunately fell and died there. And the way his family has handled this in these ensuing 25 or 20 years has been, in some ways, nothing less than extraordinary.
This is a story from Nathan Eagle, who flew over to the Big Island, to Hawaii Island, to talk to Frank Sayer and his wife, Laura Mallory Sayer. And it is very sad. The story opens up with the death of Daniel in Palolu Valley. The rescue workers did recover the body, and for that the Sayers are grateful. But they wondered, well, one, what can we do to thank these people that put their own lives at risk? And two, how come they didn't have longer ropes to rappel into the valley, an area difficult to get a helicopter in? And so what they did is they set up a foundation named after Daniel, and it's now been in operation for 20 years. It's supported by groups like Bank of Hawaii, Young Brothers. Currently, they've raised about $1.5 million to help people out. And this is really a story about a tragedy that's been turned into something positive to help so many other people on the Big Island.
That's a lot of money and that's a lot of ropes, but very clearly they've been purchasing and helping to fund other things on the wish list, things that the department couldn't afford on its own.
Right. There's about 200,000 people on Hawaii Island. There's not a large tax base. It's a very large island. I mean, think about it. Rescue workers might be helping somebody who's snowboarding and someone who's boogie boarding. I mean, that shows you how huge the terrain is, how diverse. And so lifeguards and firefighters need things like communications equipment, weatherproof coats, new board shorts, even sunscreen. And yet they are often, as one guy said, using duct tape and dental floss to make ends meet. And so this is what the Sayers members are trying to do and a lot of other people helping them out. Because as you know, as we reported on this program, drowning and tourists often die from drowning in other areas, other activities. And the SARs are saying, this is very important. We've got to take care of not only our visitors, but our locals.
Which, again, goes back to the whole idea of how dependent so many of us are on the works of nonprofits. In this case, a small but very mighty one. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair has a Civil Beat reality check for us every day. In Hawaii, we talk a lot about the needs of the smallest among us, kids. The responsibility for ensuring laws to benefit them often rests with the Hawaii Keiki Caucus. Since 1994, it's worked with community youth advocates to develop initiatives addressing kids' health and well-being. The Keiki Caucus is a bipartisan group of House and Senate members, plus community organizations. And key items for this year's agenda include lowering the eligibility age for children in the Open Doors preschool program, support for social and emotional learning training for teachers, and funding to create an after-school program for public middle and intermediate schools. Senator Carl Rhodes is the co-convener of the Keiki Caucus. He's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
In looking at what seems to be, I don't want to call it exactly the linchpin, but certainly the key item on here of the Open Doors preschool program, how many more children will be affected if, in fact, the age is lowered to younger than 4 years?
I don't have an exact number. It's the program itself is difficult to tell exactly how many will be able to get in and under what conditions, but all the research indicates that the zero to three, from birth to 3 years old, is a very, very important time, and that's why we wanted to lower the age so that those who are eligible can go in younger than four.
All of this, though, presupposes a very important phrase that's in here, subject to the availability of funds. Are there really funds to be able to open the Open Doors program to more children?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, yes and no. It's all available. That's why it's uncertain as to how many kids will get in. But, there's going to be a prioritization done. There already is. But if you lower it to the higher priority is the underage four group because, as I mentioned, all the research indicates that those first 3 years are incredibly important. And so I think that this will probably have the unfortunate result of we'll probably lose some of the older than four simply because that's not as important an age. It's still important, but it's not as important as the first 3 years.
For so many years, we've heard the birth to five as being the most important. And so now you're saying that that's been lowered from birth to three?
Well, all the studies that I've read or read about indicate that zero to three it's not that four and five aren't important, but zero to three is their brains are still built. Kids' brains are still building, and if you stimulate them in the right way, let's talk about reading to your children is very important. But it's not just important from sort of learning vocabulary. It actually builds. The brain will build itself differently. There'll be physical changes in the brain depending on what you do and how well you nurture your child. And so your trajectory in life are not that you can't knock a person off their trajectory in life after 3 years old, but in most cases you're on your way to wherever you're going by the time you're three.
There are some teachers who've said that by kindergarten they can predict which kids may do better or worse in school based upon how much preschool they've had. For the 4 and 5 year olds, though, that seems to disadvantage them, as you've mentioned earlier. Why advantage one group and disadvantage the other?
Well, the zero to three group is where basically when you have limited resources, that's where you get the most bang for your buck, and the little ones are the ones who are most easily put on a good course, and if we had unlimited resources, and don't get me wrong, we're not writing people off. You know, once you're 3 years old and you know you're not on the, on a good course, and we're writing you off. No, it's just that from a priorities perspective and from how much money we have to spend, it makes more money to spend the money on the really young ones than it does if you have to choose. The really young ones are the higher priority.
At this point, do you have any sense of how the funds are going to be flowing into this program? This program's had a long history of not necessarily, you know, being first priority.
Well, and that's part of the reason the Keiki Caucus, one of the reasons I was interested in being involved in the Keiki Caucus is because I think we do tend to shortchange our kids. I mean, good parents, you know, Democrats are sort of accused of not being particularly family-friendly, but I think the research I've read over the last couple of years is that it's parents are incredibly important, and when the state or the government gets involved with 0 to 3 year olds, it's usually we're trying to make up for some problem that's happened in the family, and you know we need to emphasize these early years more because just from a monetary perspective, if we can get kids on the right track, we won't have to spend so much money on them later down the road. In fact, I think it probably would make sense to have free preschool and get rid of the senior year in high school because we would be better off if we caught kids early and then weren't trying to make up thing and trying to address later problems at, you know, at age 17. I know that's a radical proposal, and it's something we haven't ever really seriously considered, but I think the evidence indicates that we would probably be better off if we concentrated on the younger ones.
Carl Rhodes, so that seems to say, again, we're going to disadvantage one group in favor of another when the learning at 17, when the, you know, brain is still going through a great deal of development, the seat of judgment, reason that we've been told doesn't in fact solidify until somewhere in the 20s, it seems like, you know, that might not necessarily be a fair trade-off. Why can't it be both if we say that we value kids and education so much?
Well, it can be both, and that would be what I would that's what I support, but
I mean, we tried universal preschool or something that amounted very clearly for all 4-year-olds, and that failed a few years ago.
Yes, and that was put to a vote of the electorate, and they rejected it. So, you know, we're left in a situation where we do have to make some pretty hard choices about, you know, where we think we can get the most bang for the buck. And I think it's clear that the very early 0 to 3 is where you get the most bang for the buck.
It also seems that we're asking a basic question: how much do we really value kids? And which kids over which other children. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Rhodes represents District 13 in the Hawaii State Senate. That includes downtown Honolulu, Chinatown, and Punchbowl. The Keiki Caucus is supporting a bill that would extend the eligibility of children for the Open Doors program to under 4 years of age. And before we get on to our next conversation, here's the answer to today's backyard quiz. We took a look at plans for the construction of a fourth interstate highway on Oahu, that road, which would have been designated as Interstate 4, was proposed in 1968 to alleviate congestion on Honolulu's Mauko Arterial, as Interstate H1 was known in the territorial days. The proposed H4, or Makai Arterial, was meant to serve as an alternate route, as the name suggests. It was an attempt to preemptively address the looming traffic concerns of Honolulu, which were already becoming apparent in the 1960s. However, strong opposition from the community and state lawmakers led to the proposal being shot down. Had it been approved, Honolulu's coastline would look very different. Interstate H4 would have followed present-day Nimitz Highway, traveling along Honolulu's coast until Ala Moana, where it would then follow present-day Kapi'olani Boulevard, rejoining H1 in Kaimuki. And Nimitz Highway and Kapi'olani Boulevard were the names we were looking for today. Nobody knew them, so we'll keep our prize until tomorrow. That's today's quiz. If you've got a bit of Hawaii trivia, You can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Are you crushing crosswords while everyone else is crushing candy? Is your favorite weekend activity yelling answers at your radio? Well, guess what? Your weekends are about to get a whole lot more fun. Hi, this is Sophia Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, inviting you to join me for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, played in front of a live audience. And now you on HBR One. Tune in to Ask Me Another every Saturday at noon starting February 18th.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, with two shows nightly at the Outrigger Waikiki Beach Resort. Event calendar and tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Monsieur Lafayette.
In command where you belong.
Are you saying no sweater? We're finally on the field. We've had quite a run.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
So what happens if we win?
I go back to France. I bring freedom to my people if I'm given the chance.
We'll be with you when you do.
Go lead your man.
I'll see you on the other side.
Here we meet again.
Theater artists often feel that their professional lives don't really start until they're called upon to work on a show all day, every day, and then settle into a grueling round of 8 performances a week. Training can only take you so far. Daniel Ching has had plenty of that as a 2010 graduate of Mid-Pacific Institute's School of the Arts and a 2016 graduate of Juilliard. But he's in a new experience now. He's a member of the national touring cast of Hamilton. And we talked about what his life is like these days.
It's pretty hectic, I would say, in a really good way. We're in our second week of rehearsals here in New York. So, yeah, I rehearse 6 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Saturday. And, yeah, so it's really just been work, work, work. And, yeah, just getting the show, you know, on its feet. So, yeah.
When you work at that pace, do you find that the work kind of supplies its own energy level? Just when you think you're exhausted, you get a second wind? Does it work that way for you?
Oh, definitely.
It
yes,
does?
Yes, definitely, Chris. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've ever been in a show that has really, you know, been rehearsing so intensely, because it is such a big show. So doing the work itself definitely energizes you. Yeah, I didn't think I would, you know, have this much energy every day and, you know, be doing it day in, day out, but it's amazing material. So, yeah, it sort of just energizes you throughout the day.
Now,
definitely.
Were all the cast members starting from the same place as you, or were there some who'd already been with the show for a while?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think both the leads have done the Chicago resident touring company of Hamilton. So our Aaron Burr, he is coming from Chicago, and he was Aaron Burr in Chicago. And then our, not Eliza, but Angelica, our Angelica Hamilton, was in the original cast of Hamilton on Broadway. So she's sort of coming back and doing the national tour. So, yeah, we have a couple of the leads have been around the Hamilton circuit for a while, which is really, really cool to have these sort of, you know, veterans mixed with us, you know, new guys. So
yeah, I think it would be extremely helpful. What's your part like?
My part's really, it's cool. I have a sort of a big dancing part. I'm in the ensemble, so, you know, I don't sing as much as, you know, Hamilton or Burr and, you know, these leads who are, I mean, so awesome to be around in rehearsal. My part is a little bit more dance heavy, but I'm Charles Lee, so I sort of have this one song where I'm, you know, rapping and singing, and I have this sort of battle with Hamilton for, you know, a split second in the first act. So it's great, because for me, you know, I was sort of had a pretty heavy dance background, so mm-hmm. It's a role that's just challenging enough to, you know, showcase me a little bit singing wise, acting wise, but not, you know, not too overwhelming.
It sounds like maybe in your moment on the stage, it's kind of like going from 0 to 60 in a fairly short interval.
Yes, yes, definitely. Yeah, the show is sort of geared that way. It's, you know, very much these moments of transition, you know, to the leads and to the storytelling, you know, with just a couple people on stage, and sort of the dancing will just sort of come out of nowhere. And, yeah, it's definitely that has that 0 to 60 feel, which is really exhilarating to, you know, to do in rehearsal.
Just from a dancer's point of view, that means you've got to be really in shape, and you don't, can't build up to it, right? You've just got to get right to that spot.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's you're totally right about that. And I mean, it was helpful to have school, you know, to train, because I just graduated from Juilliard in May, and so to have that training sort of behind my belt was really really helpful, you know, coming into the rehearsal last week.
Did that training prepare you for the you know, heavily rap, hip-hop infused material you're doing now?
Yeah, in a way, actually. So I was sort of a hip-hop dancer growing up in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of just sort of stayed with me throughout my life. And I think the Juilliard training, it wasn't, you know, as focused, you know, on a lot of the rap and hip-hop style that mm-hmm. is being shown in the Hamilton show. So that was sort of something that I, you know, just sort of brought in from my past. But Juilliard sort of, as far as the athleticism in the show and that, you know, that stamina that we're talking about,
yeah.
that definitely prepared me. So, yeah.
Well, because training in other art dance forms teaches you that whole thing about being able to make a sustained performance over a long period of time and being ready every
definitely.
Night. Also, you know, the whole thing of, like, it's one thing to do a great show. It's another thing to do eight a week, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and I'm really excited, to be doing, you know, to reach that level of stamina and, you know, how do you perform to your fullest capacity, you know, as you said, you know, eight shows a week. I've never done that before. And so it's cool to be in rehearsal with, you know, a lot of my other cast members are, you know, sort of Broadway veterans. So
yeah.
they've been doing, you know, a lot of different shows, either on Broadway or, you know, national tours. So just to sort of learn how they work and how they sort of, you know, persevere through that, you know, very intense schedule is really cool. So,
yeah, because, yeah. you know, the whole thing of being a professional is learning to do your show when you've got the flu, right?
Right, exactly. And I actually had the flu the week before we started, so I think around 2-3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was like the worst timing because, you know, I was getting in shape and doing all these really awesome dance gigs in New York before we had started rehearsals last week. And then my body just shut down, and I had the flu, and I was kind of scared that I would have the flu, you know, like the first day of rehearsal. And luckily enough, I, recovered for the most part, but, you know, it was only around like 70-75% up to my normal, you know, level. And so, yeah, just to have that experience of starting rehearsals a little bit sick kind of, you know, gave me a taste of what it will be like, you know, for the next year of, you know, sometimes you just have to push through and, so totally that level is requires a consistency, which is very takes a lot of, you know, endurance. So yeah, I'm excited.
It sounds as if that's an important component of your showbiz education, Daniel.
Yes, definitely.
Well, hey, thanks very much for taking the time. I know you got a busy day. Don't forget to stretch, right?
And right, exactly. Yeah. No, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. Yeah, it's a pleasure. And it's always nice to, you know, stay connected to the Hawaii community.
Daniel Ching is a member of the touring company of Hamilton. He's a 2010 graduate of Mid-Pacific Institute School of the Arts. He earned his BFA for dance from Juilliard just last year.
The word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came. And the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
Hi, this is Lillian Zhang, producer for The Conversation. I'm in our Honolulu studios every weekday morning making sure the voices of our local officials, artists, neighbor island community makers are coming to you loud and clear. If conversations about issues that affect us here in the islands are important to you, then tell us, loudly and clearly, with your membership support. You'll find an easy-to-use donation form at hawaiipublicradio.org or call us during business hours. And thanks.
Beth Ann, I really appreciate getting a chance to talk to Barry Lopez, who's really a student of cultures around the world and feels and says that he has a great deal to learn from Hawaii.
This is true, and in fact, there's another Hawaii connection. He is in Bob Wehrman's book, Walking Man, and that's where one of the first places that I saw him recently.
Yeah. Well, it was an excellent opportunity. It really
and
was.
Good conversation that I'm sure he's going to be continuing with a lot of people who have heard him this morning when he is speaking tomorrow night. That's going to do it for today's version of the conversation. Up tomorrow, is homelessness truly a health condition? Senator Josh Green thinks so. We'll talk about his legislation that's getting a lot of attention in and out of Hawaii.
And we'll look at a theatrical retelling of the story of Jason and the Argonauts.
Just to remind you, we're 2 weeks away from moving day. Remember to hit the HPR1 preset to catch the conversation in its new time slot at 11 a.m.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past show, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. See you in the morning with more of The Conversation.